Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. And today's guest is Kumar Ramachandran. I'm very excited to be talking to Kumar today because he's someone who successfully made the transition from corporate America to entrepreneurship. He worked at Cisco for 10 plus years before starting his company CloudGenix in March 2013. He is here to talk to us today about how he made the transition and how he has been building CloudGenix. Kumar, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Absolutely thrilled to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So Kumar, 10 years is like a long time to make a transition, right? And there is an idea out there. I don't know if it is a wrong idea that if you work in a job for more than 5 years, you get too comfortable to switch. So I'm curious to know, how did you like overcome that gravity of the corporate world?
So the reality is that these things slip on surreptitiously on you without you realizing it, right? I don't think I had a plan to work at Cisco for over 10 or 12 years when I initially joined. What happened, though, is that every 2 or 3 years, I thought I was doing a fundamentally different job, right? I changed roles, I changed positions, both vertical and horizontal movement I did have. Now, through all of that, right, what was there is, I think we all need to really understand what motivates us, right? Motivations are different for different people. Some people are excited by new technology. Some people are super excited by leadership. In my case, what I discovered is that I really get motivated tremendously by my ability to have substantial impact, right? When I have substantial impact, it's fun. It gets me going. It allows me to wake up an hour before my body clock wants to. I go to bed an hour after my body clock wants to go to bed. That, you know, that is my driver. And it's different for everyone of us. So, you know, I was lucky enough to realize a driver. And so I always sought positions where I could have, I could see the impact of my work, right? That if I didn't work for a week or I was on vacation, I'm like, okay, this is what is not going to happen. Not that any of us are indispensable, but it's a very rich and rewarding feeling. So I did move from engineering to product management to owning and managing parts of the business, continuously in an ability to be able to see the direct and indirect impacts of my work.
So Kumar, you told us about what you did at Cisco and what motivated you. And before we go into what you did after that, I want to step back a little bit and ask you about your childhood days. You were originally a South Indian by heritage, but you grew up in Mumbai, right? How did you end up there?
Yeah. Oh, so it's a little bit of family history there, where my grandparents, they were farmers, they are farmers, and in South India, in a small village called a town called Pudukkottai in Tamil Nadu. And what happened pretty much is that there was a devastating drought, right, from being a really rich, fertile set of lands. It just got completely devastated by droughts. And this was in an era where irrigation was not as much there. So pretty much the what happened
was
is...
Was it in the 20s, 30s, 40s? When was it?
This would have been in the this should have been in the 50s, right? Okay. 40s and 50s.
I see.
That's where it should have been. And you know, my dad was growing up. He grew up as one of as the eldest of I think a really large number of children, as the case was at that time.
Yeah.
So probably a dozen or more.
Yeah.
Siblings. And, you know, after starting life out really, really luxuriously, very quickly, unfortunately for the family, this became extreme difficulty economically. And one day he tells his dad that he's going to head out to the big city to try and find fortune for his family. And because my grandfather was in a position where there really wasn't much to hold anything back, he allows this little kid, you know, barely a middle schooler, to go out to the big city. And I think my dad, he jumped on trains, buses, at completely at the mercy of and kindness of strangers. and he lands up in Bombay, and he figures a way to, with friends, family, sleeping in a different house almost every evening. He survives, and then what he really has in his head is burning ambition, yeah. Right? His burning ambition, and this is why I think it's important for all of us to find our mojo. His burning ambition was to give a good life to the family, extended family that he left behind in his village, right? So despite the fact that, you know, there was barely anything to eat, nowhere to stay, he was singularly motivated at the fact that a good education is somehow going to get him the opportunity to create a good life for himself and his family. So he puts himself through engineering, right? Make sure he gets through school, gets into engineering.
So he was very young when he moved to Mumbai. In that case, he didn't even finish his engineering.
He did the first stint was very young, and then as he got into engineering, I think he shunted between Mumbai and South India, and he got through his engineering back in South India. I think throughout his entire life, barring 1 year where he worked, I think an odd job. He spent his entire life in the nuclear research facilities in Bombay, in BARC, Baba Atomic Research Center, as an engineer and as a scientist working. And what was always interesting to me is that if we stay true to our motivations, good things happen, right? So nothing about his career ever moved him away from his motivation that he was in it to help a really large extended family, both his own family and all the people that helped him, right? So when you were growing up,
he would like send money to the extended family and like support them financially and stuff like that. Is it?
That's right. And in fact, oftentimes we feel a little uncomfortable, right? Because, growing up, I was a stupid kid then. I'm a stupid adult now. But as a stupid kid, you always want more, right? Mm-hmm. The shinier shoe, the shinier toy, and living in a community where everyone's an officer, everyone's a scientist, an engineer, you feel a little awkward if you're not at parity with your peers. There was this incident one day where my dad pulls me aside, and I'm griping and complaining in my stupid teenage manner. Why I can't get this shiny new toy. And I forget what it was, but he pulls me aside and says, I'm going to tell this to you once. And after that, neither are you going to ask me, nor am I going to tell you. And that's when he told me this whole story of, his childhood, how he grew up and what his motivation is and how he considers himself to be in the debt of all the people that helped him achieve whatever he achieved in life. Mm-hmm. So as it turns out, he's supporting a very large number of people, many of whom probably don't even realize that he is actually helping them out. But he bears in mind that, hey, if I slept for one night on someone's porch, I'm in that person's debt, and I'm going to help out their kids and make sure that I repay that debt. So I think just that innate sense of integrity, that innate sense of staying true to why you started doing something. Because it's very easy as we go through these journeys, right, to forget why we start doing something. Oftentimes, we start a job being super excited, wanting to accomplish something. And then along the way, we kind of lose the reason for doing what we did, right? The reason why you're excited about technology. Why are you excited about showing up at work? I think if you remember those reasons, then it allows you to do great things. Because in the end, especially as we fast forward to today, and we look at, especially for those of us in high tech and these kinds of fields, the difference between the 1% and the top 10% and then the top 50%, these are all marginal, mm-hmm. right? These don't necessarily come back to aptitude or training or even ability. Mm-hmm. It truly comes down to how much incremental effort are you willing to put, right? And that truly distinguishes out the top 1% versus the top 50% after a certain level of capability.
And that incremental effort you can put only if you have your purpose, which is what you said your dad taught you. We have it way easier compared to what he had to go through. right? So you worked at Cisco for 10 plus years and then finally you had this idea to start this company CloudGenX and you decided to quit. Tell us about that day that you decided to quit. What happened that day?
Oh, goodness. So I left Cisco after about, I think, 12 or so years. Uh-huh. And, you know, like many of us, right, I never saw myself as a big company guy. I always thought I was changing jobs. I was this fast-moving, true startup kind of person within a large company. But over time, I think you gather some barnacles. The day I left Cisco, I put in my papers and then, you know, I was driving my beat-up old Honda Accord at that time. And I still remember driving it in a way that my side view mirror captured or reflected Cisco's logo in it outside the building. So I angled my car, take a photograph, post it on Facebook without any commentary. I think I'm just really slick for doing it, right? It's a very stylistic way to say that Cisco is in my rearview mirror. And of course, my friends catch on to it. Everyone's rah-rah congratulating me on cutting the cord. And I'm feeling like a million bucks.
Yeah.
We're headed out on this great entrepreneurial journey with nothing but the courage between the years. And everything feels really great till I wake up the next morning at 3 a.m. with a complete panic attack. I'm like, holy crap, nobody is going to be hiring me. What did I give up? Why did I walk away from this? Do I really have something that is consequential? You know, I thought this is going to be a one-time thing. Uh-huh. It turns out this oscillation between extreme euphoria and extreme panic, that is the journey of a startup, right? And the reason is because these things are so fragile.
Yeah.
Early on when you're starting it, it's a germ of an idea. You're not really sure that there is a material market that will evolve behind it.
Yeah.
And everything is up in the air. So I think that was an indicator of things to come.
So if you were to give a context around what stage CloudGenX was during that time, so did you have the idea or was the idea still in process? Did you just have this exuberance of doing a startup? What was, which stage was CloudGenX at that time when you quit?
So, you know, this might be useful for any of your prospective entrepreneurs listening in. You certainly want to ensure that you're keeping things clean, right? So we were very conscious that I didn't want to work on the CloudGenX project while being employed by Cisco,
yeah.
Right? I wanted a clean break, right? So when I left Cisco, there was a germ of an idea that...
What was the germ of the idea?
Yeah, the germ of the idea really came from three big areas, right? I'm a big, big, big believer that you should only start, you know, create venture-funded startups in large markets. And there's lots of good reasons for it. Not the least of it being that if you're not prosecuting a really large market opportunity, it's not clear to me that it's a venture-funded investment. It becomes more of a lifestyle business. So in the wide area network, this is a, you know, $25 billion, $40 billion market
I thought was
right for disruption.
For someone who is not like very familiar with technical stuff, what is wide area network?
That's great. So let's say you walk into a retail store, right? In the US, let's say a Macy's, a Nordstrom, or a bank branch, all these remote locations, they get connected back to the data center, back to clouds, and the connectivity model, as well as the devices that allow for that connectivity, that allow for security, that allow for performance management, that go into these remote offices, that is the space we're talking about.
I see.
Right? And
so similarly, if I have like a factory, I remember the company that I used to work at, on the factory floor, there was a scanning machine in the first floor and the scanning machine on the second floor and the inventory machine on the fourth floor. All of these are connected to the central inventory system that the company had. And that is also a wide area network.
Absolutely. So okay. All your scanning systems on the various floors,
yeah.
They would go talk to a router that's probably kept in a closet somewhere in one of those floors. And then that router would go across the wide area network, maybe over MPLS, over internet. These are technologies and methods of transport, going back to the data center where the ERP applications were likely hosted at that time, right? And that market, it hadn't seen material innovation for quite some time, and it was a really large market, and that was a great thing. Now, the second big factor really was that there truly was the beginning of technology disruption in that space, where historically all the vendors only provided hardware-based solutions. And what we saw really was that there was the opportunity to fundamentally transform from hardware to software. And that transformation could be extremely interesting to customers, not only from a cost perspective, but also from a capabilities, features, functions. The moment you move from hardware to software, you can start doing a lot of interesting things because your pace of innovation, the kinds of capabilities you can deliver, they change pretty dramatically. Mm-hmm. And then there was a third big factor. I always believe that if you put yourself in the shoes of a CIO, right, what you will see is that on any given day, you probably have 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 projects, all of them with positive ROI. Your million-dollar question is, which of these projects do you pick? Your top 10 is going to consist of projects that have huge tailwinds associated with them, mm-hmm. right? So my belief firmly is that if you're starting a company, if you're starting a new product line, you want to do it in a way where either you can create a tailwind by the help of industry analysts, etc., or you can leverage strong secular forces, right? The strong secular force in our case really is the migration to the cloud, right? The cloud, while it was real 10 years ago, it has become very, very real in the last 18, 24 months for a lot of customers. So, those three factors, right? Very large market, being disrupted by strong technology change mm-hmm. with a strong secular tailwind. I think that if you have those three, I think then you can go and try to create a venture-funded startup.
I see. So you knew this. All these three were happening with wide area networks, and that's about it. That is the. Or did you have any idea of what you wanted to do when you quit your job at Cisco?
No, I truly didn't have for the better and the worse, right? We didn't have much beyond it, and part of it was we didn't want to start working on this while still being employed at Cisco, and part of it was there was a ton of discovery to be done.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've learned is that it's good not to believe too much all the wonderful noises between the ears. It's always good to get out of the building and get validation from customers, right? And that validation takes a lot of different forms. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes you just talk to a customer, you show them pretty slides, etc. I'm a big subscriber to this thesis called the Lean Startup. The godfather of the Lean Startup movement really is a person called Steve Blank, who wrote a seminal book on customer development. The insights that Steve provides really is that all the answers are outside the building. Very few of them are in the building. And outside of the building, what you really have to do is extract out the right answer from your customers. It's usually not easy to get the right answers simply because it could be something as easy as people are too nice, mm-hmm. right? Nobody wants to tell you that your baby is ugly.
Yeah.
People with the best of intentions can give you the worst of advice.
Yeah. So you had these three things, and it was almost like jumping into a lake of cold water, right? You knew there were no crocodiles in it, but you didn't know how to swim. So what were the first few steps? What was the first, 2 to 3 months like? Were you trying to find co-founders? Were you trying to do market research? Or did you have, what was the first few steps for the CloudGenX?
So a little bit of all of the above. So when we talk about garage-funded startups in the Valley, we truly were one of those, right? So we actually hung out in the garage of one of my co-founders.
Did you already have co-founders when you left?
Yeah, so we assembled, you know, we started reaching back to the network and finding people that we'd worked with. I think in terms of a co-founding team, two or three things certainly were very beneficial in our case. One is, I think it helps tremendously if you work with some of the people that you're going to co-found with, because you know, you've been through good times, you've been through bad times. You know, the team has a certain chemistry. Now, you know, the new team will evolve its own chemistry, and your experience at a different company doesn't necessarily translate, but at least there is a basis for it. And the second is finding a team that was very complementary, right? I had someone who could lead the engineering team. I had someone who could be the architect for the company. And then I brought the business angle to it. So we really were lucky that we had a pretty complete team. And that was one of the powerful things for us. Now, this quote-unquote complete team. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's one thing that even Steve Blank talks about a lot. Right, you need three kinds of people, and I believe the developer, the business guy, and the sales guy. I think you seem to have the three. I am not using the right words. Do you remember what words that Steve Blank uses for the three people that you need in the company?
No, I don't. But then you know, you mentioned the developer, the sales guy, and the maybe the business person.
Yeah.
What we had was the engineering leader, the architects, and the business guy.
Uh-huh.
What we didn't have actually at that time, and most startups will not have, is the sales guy, right?
Uh-huh.
Because you know, the perception is going to be, hey, you know, till the time we don't build a product, you don't need a sales guy.
Uh-huh.
And one of Steve's insights is that actually you need to start selling even before you have a product, truly to understand what your customers want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I donned the mantle of the sales guy. And that was one of the most brutalizing experiences for me. You know, I had left Cisco as a, you know, with a team that worked for me, and we had large sales organizations, etc. And access to customers was never a problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You raised your hand, and you could get access to almost any customer on planet Earth with the badge. And then all of a sudden, I find myself cold calling people off of LinkedIn, sending them emails, and really getting the largest number of rejections. You know, pretty much you send an email to someone you thought was a friend, or you know, was at least a business associate.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, more often than not, the email went into a black hole. It was very difficult. You know, I won't pretend it was easy at all. You know, everyone develops their techniques. You know, you give the analogy of jumping into the cold water.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is, right?
Yeah.
You throw yourself into the deep end of the pool, deep end of the ocean, and either you're going to survive or you're going to sink. And the only way to survive, at least for me, was just to be really, really gritty. You know, there's a word called hustle.
Yeah.
Which just holds tremendous value in my book. If there's anything I've learned in the last 3 years, is that hustle is probably trumps so many other rich qualities that we otherwise seek. So you know, if I didn't get a response to an email, I started then devising, because I was left to my own means, ways to get responses from customers.
Mm-hmm.
How do we sign up people as advisors into the company? How do we create with them a sense that they are truly part of a mission? How do we ensure that the feedback they're providing us is not muddied and colored by them wanting to be nice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to say, unless you're presenting something exceptionally stupid, when you're presenting a handful of slides that are talking about future things and, hey, here's how transformation is going to happen, very rarely are you going to get someone saying, oh, that's just stupid.
Yeah.
Right? People
are
going, hey, that's exciting. That's interesting. You're talking to other technologists, so they're all going to get excited. But not everything that's exciting is going to make a real business. So really, the the question is, how do you extract the information that will truly validate, clear out the noise, and create a sustainable business for you? And this is where Eric Ries, Steve Lang's student, with this whole lean startup methodology, it was something we adopted very early on. And frequently, we'd get past Lightware. We'd actually go create prototypes that we'd ask customers to go deploy in their production environments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the real objections would come up.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah. I'm concerned about the security implications. I'm concerned about having some traffic go through the cloud. Or what were the real objections were?
What was the use case you first tried to solve? The first customers that you tried to deploy your prototypes to, what was the use case at that time?
So, the reality is that the 10,000 feet use case, 10,000 feet problem we were solving, that hasn't changed from then to now,
uh-huh.
which was that we were trying to create for our customers, one, a network where from that remote office, when you go to the cloud, when you go to the data center, you can go very easily with simple policy statements. Two, can I use broadband? Right? For us, right now, you and I are talking over a broadband network. And traditionally, in all the enterprises, broadband is still not used as a primary form of transport, right? Because the concern is that, is it secure enough? Can you optimize for performance? Can you manage for availability? And part of our thesis was that we can take that broadband network that costs, let's say in the US, $100 per month per site, and make it as good and as effective for an enterprise as a $1,000 connection, so that we can give the customer a 10x benefit in terms of costs and capacity, right? So that was the use case we were going after even back then. And but the nature and the form of the product took a lot of twists and turns. So to give you a very concrete example, one of the things we played with early on was that, hey, maybe if you put some nodes in the cloud, those nodes could help with the delivery of the application flows. And what we found is that in the enterprise space, customers just didn't like their traffic traversing through multiple hops in the cloud. And what they really wanted was direct paths, point A to point B, without going through waypoints in the middle. And in all the customer discussions with Slideware, everyone was okay with the original approach.
Mm-hmm.
But when we actually built a prototype and asked them to consume it, that's when the real objections and the real concerns that their security teams had came out to the fore. Now, if we hadn't done this, right, because we got positive feedback based on Slideware, we'd have spent $10 million in building the original spec of the product, and we'd have spent 2 years and $10 million building something that wasn't right for the market.
Yeah.
Because we built this rapid prototype, and it was designed as an experiment, right? We didn't design it as, hey, this is the first iteration of the product. No. This truly was an MVP designed to extract from the customer whether this is the right product or not.
Yeah.
So we built in a few short months, with a few small number of developers at a relatively much smaller cost, something that otherwise would have taken the company 2 years and $10 million to do, right? And that in the end is the power of the lean startup methodology. One of the things I like to ask people is, when does the startup fail,
mm-hmm.
right? And usually people's answers is, when you don't have product market fit, and you don't have the right kind of people, the right kind of technology, all those are true. But I like to snidely say, a startup really fails when it runs out of money.
Yeah.
That's when you're failed. So then, you can be a failing startup, but you're not yet failed. The trick of a startup is that between funding and running out of money, you find your product market fit,
mm-hmm.
and you find your scalable sales cycle to market fit, and you start becoming a customer-funded company instead of a VC-funded company, right? And that's what the lean startup truly accelerated for us.
I see. Before I move on to the next one about what happened during the holiday season, I just quickly wanted to mention the three things that Steve Lang talk about that you need in a company are the hacker, hustler, and the designer to build a tech team in every company. And I believe it was Steve Blank who coined the term, but I might be mistaken.
Oh, probably absolutely true. I think, Steve, I've been very lucky to have been exposed to Steve. In fact, I believe I took the very first class that Steve gave at Haas on entrepreneurship and customer development. And, when I actually took that class, there's an interesting story behind it where, I was doing my evening MBA at Berkeley. And, you have to sign up for the popular courses ahead of time. And I think I was lax in signing up in time. And then I show up for an entrepreneurship class, unsure of is that what I really wanted to do. And in walks someone, he's holding some, poorly organized papers, crumpled papers in his hand. And he walks into the class. Looking very different from most of our other professors, right? Where, the average professor who teaches you in the evening MBA class, they'd have set up everything online electronically, and there's just a very strict approach they follow. Not strict, but very structured approach they follow. It all seemed very loosey-goosey to me. So, he comes and he starts at 7 p.m. or some such in the evening. That's when these classes are held.
Yeah.
And so you're really tired after a long day of work and thinking to myself, maybe I should have signed up for a different class or something. And then Steve starts talking about customer development. First few minutes, I'm like, yeah, I'm a product manager. I know these things. I'm not sure I'm going to be learning something new here. And then after 10 or 15 minutes, I just realized that this is the best thing that I ever learned in my professional career. So I believe this was his very first, this was before he wrote the customer development book.
Yeah.
And a lot of those notes that he had, they are part of what became that very useful book. So for all your listeners, certainly I'd go read Steve's blog, Steve's books.
Yeah.
I think there's just, it's almost like a manual for an entrepreneur.
Yeah, Steve is an impressive guy. I had the fortune of listening to him in a lecture. And he comes up, he says the first 5 minutes, I have no notes, I'm not sure what I'm going to talk about. And then he goes on giving this amazing lecture ever delivered for the next 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So he has this ability to do it on the fly, which is very impressive. So going back to CloudGenX, so you had some early wins in your company, right? I believe Columbia Sportswear is one company which adapted CloudGenX and their solutions very early. What were some of the wins with that company that CloudGenX has achieved?
Yeah, so that's a great, question. Simply because your customers, your early customers will determine the fate of your company, right? And the reason for it is that you will, whether you like it or not, you will build features, capabilities, pivots that account for those early customers. So there's a lot of magic in making sure that you choose the right kind of customers. It's going to sound, it's going to sound a little arrogant, but none of us should ever be afraid to fire a customer, right? And what it means is that early on, if you're looking at a space, looking at a customer, and if you're not the right fit or the customer is not the right fit, I think you as an entrepreneur, it's very difficult to do because you're literally seeking that the customers to use your product, but you have to fire your customer if the product is not a right fit, it doesn't fit the vision, it doesn't, the customer is at a different stage, right? You have certain customers who truly are going to be your greatest champions in the middle cycle of market adoption. They're not the early adopters. They're going to have a bar and a set of requirements that are very different. Your early customers, they will find you, right? The reason I say they will find you, it's not to say that you're going to sit back and, people are going to make a beeline to your door. You're going to be hustling. You're going to be fighting to find them. But in the end, they will find you, meaning that they will have and they will express a problem that is not a headache, but a problem that's a migraine, that only your product can solve for them.
And because your product is solving it so elegantly and in such a compelling manner for it, for them, they will take chances with you, or what seem like chances, right? So, you know, in the case of Columbia Sportswear, even early on, literally weeks before Thanksgiving, which is when you get Black Friday and the peak holiday shopping season.
Thanksgiving of 2015, right?
That's right. They're like, hey, we're going to go deploy this product in several of our stores over the course of the next week. And actually sit down with them and say, guys, we love our product, but do you really want to go deploy us in 10 new stores a week before the biggest shopping weekend of the year? What happens if something goes wrong, right? And their answer was very telling. They said, we have greater risk staying with our current product, current solution, current architecture than embracing your product, right? And that's when you know that this is a strong relationship. In fact, in one of the stores, in a mall in New Jersey, it actually played itself out, right? What happened was that many malls in the U.S., they have the your connectivity into the mall oftentimes is almost monopolistic, right? You'll get a major connection into the mall that's shared across, splintered across all the stores in the mall. Everyone has to subscribe to that connection. And they were concerned that, you know, it was a single point of failure. So they wanted to bring a LTE, right, your 4G LTE connection as a backup into that store. And they had done it, and then with the legacy routers, they just weren't happy with how it was behaving. So they put CloudGenix in. We absorb this connection into the mall. We absorb the LTE connection, and we do our magic to ensure availability, performance, etc. Now, almost like out of a book, what happens is that right before that weekend, the main connection to the mall is taken out by a backhoe, right? So now you are stuck in a situation where the only connection for the store is an LTE 4G connection. But it seemed really good, right? Our system monitors the connection, looks at the capability, everything seemed really good. But then what happens is that just when Black Friday rush comes in, everyone walks into the malls with their cell phones. And because it's, again, all these cell phones are trying to jump onto the 4G LTE tower, the cell tower, local cell tower capacity gets taken down. So suddenly the LTE connection becomes extremely congested. Now, some of the other stores that didn't have CloudGenix in that mall, their routers detect that, oh, the LTE is down. So, you know, long lines form outside. People have to do manual credit card processing with those photocopy process, phone calls, whatever. Whereas for Columbia, what our system does, because of our technology, we actually detect that it's extremely congested. It's not down, right? It's a brownout situation. It's not a blackout situation. And then we have techniques to fight for our fair share of capacity. We have techniques to correctly prioritize your retail store applications. So we do all of that. And Columbia store is the only one who's functioning perfectly well, right? So the outcome of that was that the customer took a shot, and their judgment was that it's more risky to stay with status quo than to embrace the startup's product right 1 week before the biggest shopping weekend. And that's how it played out, right? And that's usually a sign that this is the kind of customer that you truly want in the early stage of the company, because they'll take a chance with you and they will guide you into areas that are going to be beneficial for your company.
I asked you when you were talking earlier if you had any big disasters that happened with your company or when any of your product deployment. You said we don't have big disasters. Why is that?
I like to say that there's two things. One is, you know, you want a lot of small disasters so that you can avoid the big disaster. If you don't have small disasters, then it's an indication of two things in my mind. One, you're not pushing the envelope enough. You're not taking enough risks. And as a startup, strangely enough, if you don't take enough risks, you will die, right? The reason for your existence is that you're pushing the envelope. So you do want those risks to show up. And you also want a separate set of calculated failures, planned failures, right? Meaning that you're running experiments on your product, on your customer base. You're running experiments on your team. These are planned experiments. And, you know, by design, some of them will fail, some of them will succeed, but it's not failing and succeeding there. You're going to get results and you're going to make decisions, right? It's less about failure and success. The thing that we try and be very careful about in that is making sure that we reward all of it, right? So for instance, we had to make an architectural decision. In the world of networking for, if you're trying to find the true real-time capacity of a pipe, right? You have to flood the pipe, right? Let's say there's a water pipe. How do you measure the real-time capacity of a water pipe in case the pipe shrinks and grows constantly? You have to flood it with water, see, you know, do a speed test, so to speak, see how much comes out point A to point B. And the same is true of networks. The trouble, though, is that if you're flooding a customer's network, that's going to impact the production traffic.
Yeah.
So one tough problem to solve really is that how do you measure the true capacity of a network that changes its capacity in real time without flooding the network? Now, there are conservative ways to do it. There are legacy ways to do it that have adverse impact on the network. That's a choice. Mm-hmm. And then you can truly do some path-breaking stuff. So when we were faced with that, we said, okay, we're going to do this path-breaking stuff. But by definition, if something is path-breaking, it is going to be littered with things you try and fail.
Yeah.
So as we started embarking on that journey 3 years ago, we had 2, 3, 4, 5 failures, mm-hmm. right, in things that we tried. And the thing that, as a leader, I need to be very conscious of is that you're celebrating those failures, right? Because if you don't, then what the culture in your team will be that, let's take the safe path.
Yeah.
A safe path is going to get you terribly close to legacy, right? If you're disrupting an existing market, which is what we're doing, we're not creating a brand new market. This is truly the disruption of an existing market. You better have capabilities, features, disruption that is 24, 36 months away from the incumbent. If you only do stuff that's within a 12-month window, I don't think you have earned the right to exist mm-hmm. with your customers.
Yeah.
Right. So hence, we plan for a lot of little disasters, little failures, and we play with it ahead of time. We also took a page out of Amazon. Right. One of the things that I think Netflix and AWS, Netflix and their AWS deployment did, they came out with this notion of the chaos monkey, right, where they consciously, during working hours, shoot various parts of the system down and see how it reacts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the concept truly of having a lot of small disasters to avert the large disaster.
Yeah.
So you consciously create lots of failures during the day. You catch them, you fix them, so that you prevent the chances of a big failure, unplanned failure happening. So we actually exercise those kinds of things in our system pretty actively.
I see. How do you shoot parts of the system down? Like, I'm curious to know how does it actually happen?
So it happens in a variety of ways. We do have code snippets
okay.
That during our working hours, they'll actually go and take down different parts of the system. Oh. It'll actually shoot various parts of the system down, and we see if the resiliency that we build in doesn't kick in.
Yeah.
We check to see if the support systems behave as advertised,
mm-hmm.
right? So, for instance, and you never know when something goes wrong until you actually try it out. If someone calls our support number, what happens,
mm-hmm.
right? Does it go to, is there a failure in the cloud? Is there a full end-to-end process that's happening there as designed? And we'll actually cause some failures, yeah. right? We'll tell the guy, okay, don't pick up the phone, right? The first line support, don't pick up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what happens. Does it automatically then get escalated out? Does it age out? You know, creating, and we do that on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
right? Every day we're failing something or the other in a controlled environment. And it's on the technology side. It's even on the business side,
mm-hmm.
right? And the business side, we actually do run some, whether it's pricing experiments, whether it's offer experiments with channels, with customers, we're doing that constantly.
Yeah. I've heard people do this on personal stuff, like people fast 1 day a week. That is kind of breaking the system, so to speak. And there is this author, Nassim Taleb, who talks about this concept in detail in a book called Anti-Fragile. I'm not sure if you ever came across that book, but this is exactly what he talks about at length, and I'm sure you'll love it. But as I'm doing this interview, right, I'm beginning to realize your product is very enterprise-focused, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious to know why you are doing this interview, to be honest, because most people who are going to buy this product, it's very unlikely they would do it out of an interview, right? Like most people who reach out to me, for example, they have a consumer-facing product and they want to, you know, sell it to like individuals. So I'm very honored that you're doing it. I'm very happy that you are, but I'm also curious why.
So I'm in the debt of more people than I can count. When I left Cisco, right? You are right in pointing out that after you spend a while in a place and you know, you kind of earn your chops, you know, got into a reasonably senior position, there's an enormous sense of comfort. And I truly didn't know what I didn't know when I cut the cord. As I went into this bold, unknown world of entrepreneurship and startup, the number of people, strangers, right, perfect strangers, that have helped me, either by doing reviews of my deck, or giving suggestions, making introductions, opening doors, giving me advice, they are too many for me to name. And in every case, to the last woman and man, when I asked them, hey, how can I repay this? You know, the answer always is paid forward, right? The culture of entrepreneurship, the culture of Silicon Valley, and I use Silicon Valley not as a place, but really as a concept, is that we all benefit by sharing and paying it forward. I still learn more from every other entrepreneur I talk to than they learn from me. So, you know, my motivation in doing this here is to share my experiences, share my journey. And if there is, one thing that people get, anyone that listens to this gets out of it, it is that bet on yourself and do it, right? Bet on yourself and do it. Don't hold back. I'm not a guy that likes to apply the rewind and look at the rearview mirror a whole lot. But if there were any reason for me to do it, and any reason for me to make left turns where I made right or where I stayed the course, it would be to do this sooner, right? There is always a million reasons not to bet on yourself, not to do a startup. And there's only one reason to do it. The one reason to do it is because you're going to firmly believe in yourself, right? You're going to believe in yourself more than anything. And when I say believe in yourself, it's not from a place of, you don't do it from a place of arrogance, but you do it from a place of extreme commitment, right? You know that you're going to just hustle and fight through, plow through, and not give up ever, ever, ever. And if that's how your constituency is, you should just do it, right? And that's the motivation in the end, right? Yeah. Much like my dad, I'm in the debt of strangers. In my case, I didn't sleep on their porches, but they gave generously of their time.
In the digital age, it's different. You sleep on digital porches, I guess. So, what's next for, actually, before you tell us about what's next, how has 2016 been going so far and what are your revenues like?
Yeah, so if you think about this company, right, so it got started out in 2013. You know, we took 18-24 months to build the product out in a manner that was very close with a ton of customers. For us, 2016 has been about sales and sales growth, right? Where we brought in our very first head of sales. So the whole process of finding the right head of sales and building out the right sales team, it's a big shift in the life of a company, right? Most technology companies, whether consumer or enterprise focused, they are technology companies. So there's going to be a center of gravity towards the engineering, towards the product. And you certainly want that, right? That's the reason for your early existence. But at some point, what you have to do very consciously is shift that balance. and you shift the balance to create parity from engineering to sales, right? So as the sales teams come in, the things that we've been focused tremendously on is how do we ensure that we create an incredible sales culture of friendly competition, of pushing each other to new heights, and infusing that in both engineering and in sales, and really making sure that neither organization is a stepchild, right? It's not that, hey, the founders sit in San Jose, they're building these great products, so that's where the center of gravity is.
Yeah.
You truly want the center of gravity to be your customers, right? And sales is the best proxy for that. So I like to say we're a sales-led company. And what I really mean is that we're a customer-led company. We go where our customers want us to go by selecting the right customers and by serving them really, really well. So this year really has been, for us, it's been about managing growth, right?
Yeah.
Anytime you grow rapidly from 25 to 50 people and to 100 people, you lose, you know, you're under the threat of losing a lot of things.
Yeah.
Your, you know, your speed, right? Your startup culture, some of the values the team holds near and dear to, all of which when you're geographically co-located are somewhat easy. As you become this dispersed company, it becomes tougher and tougher. Mm-hmm. So 2016 for us has been about growth.
Yeah, can you give us a range of the revenue, what it was or what it is targeted to be for 2016?
Whatever range
you're comfortable with.
Is it like one to numbers?
Is it 1 to 5 or 5 to 10 or like just a range so that we know what we're talking about?
Right. We don't put out our revenue numbers, but just to give you a sense of where the company is, we process about a billion transactions each and every day through our systems. We're deployed in all 6 continents. I like to say that bottom 5% will be sent to Antarctica for deployment. That's the one continent I don't think we have a device yet. And, you know, the market cap of our customers, they are north of 100 billion, right?
Okay.
So some of the largest banks, financial firms, retailers, manufacturing firms have deployed our products worldwide, right? So the company certainly is doing well. But it's only because of staying really, really focused on ensuring customer success.
What's next? What's 2016 and beyond for CloudGenix?
So if you look at the 2 or 3 things that go into making of any company, right? I'll start with the technology. I'm still a technologist at heart. I think when you look at technology, certainly the big thing that we see is that we've taken the network to a place where the network is a database, right? Everything about the network is captured in our system as data, whether it's the actual flows, whether it's the concept of the network, whether the implementation of the network. I'm just a big believer that deep learning techniques applied to data are extremely transformative. So, we've been making some forward-looking investments when it comes to what we do with the data in the network, and not just the data in the network, but the network itself as a database. And so we, much like Uber comes out with self-driving cars, we expect to come out with very, very interesting constructs based on deep learning against the network. When I look at our sales and our sales footprint, I think we expect to, we have a good presence in the U.S. We're looking at augmenting and going deep internationally,
mm-hmm.
right? So we did it in 2 phases, like many companies. So certainly for your listeners outside of the U.S., they'll find more of us, their regions and geographies. And then from a marketing perspective, it really is about ensuring that our core message, right? What happens is that the core message appeals to a certain class of customer, right? It's a forward-looking disruption message. It now needs to translate to a broader base of customers, broader parts of the market. So those are some of the big transitions that we have to drive.
You are a voracious reader, right? Do you have any book recommendations for us?
I'm a huge listener to audiobooks. Like many people in the Bay Area, I have a long commute, and what I find is that audiobooks make me a patient driver, and it also takes away the sting of the commute. Some of the books that I've truly enjoyed in recent times, certainly Eric Ries, his Lean Startup, I'd highly recommend it to any entrepreneur. Ben Horowitz's The Hard Thing, about hard things, I think it's just a phenomenal book. Anyone that is thinking about jumping into the wild should read it, not to get scared, but to just be prepared for the journey a little bit. Outside of that, I'm constantly trying to read stuff. I think Mark Benioff of Salesforce, he has a great book too. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a handbook for many things that startups do. So certainly those are three books I throw out as recommendations. It is the holiday season right now. And so if people are looking for maybe something less intense along those ways, I'd certainly recommend a book on Wilbur and Orville Wright, right? The Wright brothers, and their book on their life journey, where they have a great journey. There's a book called Narrated by David McCullough, written and narrated by David McCullough. It just goes through the Wright brothers' journey, and they had an incredible journey too. And what stands out in their journey is that they built many of their planes in North Carolina in a place called Kitty Hawk, which is biting cold, intense wind, sand in your eyes. Any of us would think that, man, that's just like such a tough environment. And they just relished it. And they relished it because they were so passionate about finding the right conditions. They needed that wind and the cold, not the cold, but certainly the wind and the sand to test their planes. So they always looked forward to spending time in extremely harsh conditions. And it was the time of their lives,
yeah.
Right? I think that's when you know that you're doing what you should be.
What is the name of the book?
Everyone else that's looking at it is saying that, man, it seems really, really tough. And you're like, oh my goodness, I'm on vacation. I'm surprised people are paying me money for this.
That's funny. I have to get my hands on the book. I will try to find it and leave it in the show notes for anyone listening. Usually I take book recommendations from my guests, and this is the first time I have a recommendation for a guest, which is Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb. You have to read it, Kumar.
It's great. And,
if someone listening to us wants to get in touch with you, actually, before I ask you that, is there anything that I should have asked I didn't ask you?
I think we covered a pretty broad range of topics here. If I were to summarize the journey so far, and it's difficult to summarize these journeys, people oftentimes ask me what is the toughest thing about it, right? And the tough thing about it, as much as it'll seem, it is not fundraising. It is not building the product. It's not finding the solution. Those are all tough, right? The toughest thing in the end is people, right? And when I say the tough thing is people, is that your team, the people that form the team, how they truly come for the cause, how they come together as a band of, brothers and sisters on a mission, that it truly is the difference between success and failure. And in my own journey, what I find is that the most difficult thing is early on hiring the right people, extracting them out of great jobs, great places they are working, being able to communicate the vision, the passion, the opportunity, and recruiting them for the cause, right? I think you do that, then magic can happen. But certainly the bar or the a testing rod for an entrepreneur is that your ability to be honest and direct to people and still be able to recruit them for what is a really tough cause, right? The offer usually to people is that, we're going to climb this mountain together. It's going to be hot. It's going to be dry, not much water. And there might be a few wild animals along the way. Come join me on the journey, mm-hmm. right? Finding the people that find that more exciting than walking along the flat plains, that's the job.
Yeah, the Wright brothers style. So if anyone listening to us wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to connect with you online?
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. You know, people that want to reach out to me on LinkedIn, that's great. People should also feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. My handle is Kumar Bytes, KumarBytes. That's, you know, it probably gives a sense of my geeky background.
okay.
And I'm more than happy to respond. Yeah. And you know, feel free to drop me a note on LinkedIn too.
Oh, great. I will leave those in the show notes as well. Thank you so much, Kumar, for joining us today.
Absolutely. Rohit, thanks a ton.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.